This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
And hello, Hearts of Oak. Thank you so much for joining us once again for a news review. And it's great to have back with us Ben Harnwell, the international editor for War Room. Ben, thank you for your time.
Peter, it's a great pleasure as always to be invited back. Good evening to you.
Good to have you as always. We're just doing this a few hours before. Lots of stories as always. A lot of it taken from Ben's Twitter and Getter feed. But follow him on Getter. That's his handle, at Harnwell on Getter. Of course, you'll see him regularly on War Room, on Getter and Rumble. This is what you will find over on his social media. So when you jump on, you'll see him there in the left on Getter and on the right, Ben_Harnwell on Twitter. But he posts most regularly on Getter, so follow him on that. Right, let's see what first story. The first story, we actually start on a win, which is always good to start on. And that, Ben, is this intriguing story of the win you had in Italy. Let me just bring up, it's a wonderful picture here of you and Steve Bannon himself. And that is this. Daily Mail was everywhere. This was earlier this month. I think this was the 7th of the month, but it's the first time I've had you on and obviously wanted to discuss this with you. An Italian court ruled in the favour of Bannon ally Benjamin Harnwell. Group wants to run Gladiator School out of 13th century Trisulti Charterhouse. Bannon wants to set up populist nationalist academies in US and Europe. And this has been a number of years legal battle. Do you want to tell us what the battle was over and what actually you've succeeded in doing?
Well, Peter, to start off with, I have succeeded in losing a few pounds since then that photo was taken. That's the most important thing I think I'd like folk to dwell on. Look, it's unusual for me because, you know, my day job, this is where folks will know me from, is being an international correspondent on Steve Bannon's War Room. And I'm normally commenting on stories. I'm not usually the subject of stories, so that's slightly unusual for me. This has been many years in the making, in the developing. These events precede Steve Bannon's War Room and even my role with the show. Goes back to a public tender in Italy that we participated in for this monastery, this 800-year-old monastery called Trisulti, up in the mountains to the southeast, about an hour and a half to the southeast of Rome. And the project there was to have a gladiator school, known in the press as Steve Bannon's Gladiator School of Culture Warriors. And look, Peter, you can imagine how well this project went down with the lift. It went down like the proverbial lead balloon. So having participated in this tender and having won it within a few months of getting our feet under the collective desks, we were being evicted. And the ministry had basically provided three pretexts for this, because they can't just, obviously not even in Italy can a government unilaterally annul a perfectly legitimate lease, because it doesn't like the political opinions of its leaseholders. So they needed a pretext, and they said substantially three things, that we didn't have the experience or even the necessary legally required requisites to participate in the tender, that we hadn't fulfilled the lease obligations for the management of the monastery. It's like a 19-year lease, and they're getting us out within the first 3 months because they said that we hadn't fulfilled the lease obligations. And they said that I had made criminally fraudulent statements in the public tender process in order to win the monument. And all three of these things over the last few years have been overturned. We won in the Regional Administrative Tribunal of Lazio, that that was the first major court case, and that was about 4 years ago. They said that we had all the necessary experience to participate in the tender. We satisfied all the legal requisites. Then we went to the Court of Auditors that said that we had paid the rent. We hadn't defaulted the lease on terms of the rent. And then about 2 weeks ago, the criminal case. This was a far more substantial, being criminal, a criminal court of law, far more august body, after basically 3 years of court hearings every few months, hence my occasional absences from the show. That ended with the state prosecutor, Peter, saying that we took this case on. This is the state prosecutor, the public prosecutor. We took this case on because of the statements the Ministry for Culture had made publicly. It is now, after this entire process, it is absolutely clear that Harnwell, the defendant, hadn't made any fraudulent statements. So they themselves asked the judge to acquit me on those accusations. But on the other, because there were two fundamental charges on this, on the other charge to do with non-fulfillment of the rental obligations, of the lease obligations, they still asked me to have a year in prison. The judge, however, then my lawyer summed up, and then the judge, she went into her chamber to consider her verdict and came out and said, I'm giving Harnwell the maximum acquittal available under Italian law on both of these charges, because it's absolutely clear these crimes never took place. So that's the long story, the short explanation of a very long story. Hopefully, our listeners and spectators won't think that the explanation was too long. It's quite complex. The point, Peter, the takeaways of this are, because I have to go into the detail to be able to then make the follow on points. To give the basis of the justification of where I go from here. So the three points based on this that I want to underline is that the left, and I'm going to come on to this on one of the later stories, I'll come back to this, the left wanted to shut us down because it has no answer to the arguments that we're making in the public square. That is the total reason they wanted to close us down. There was nothing ever that my organization, the Dignitatis Humanae Institute, had, which is formerly the leaseholder for the monastery. There's nothing, our conduct at every stage had been exemplary. We hadn't done anything wrong. And if anything, false accusations, false declarations, objectively, have been made by the Ministry for Culture. That has been determined in court on all three of those things. False calumnies have been made against us. We have never been shown to have made any type of fraudulent statement. And in fact, no evidence has ever been provided to suggest that we made fraudulent statements, because the ministry made these statements publicly and never sued us. And they had the obligation under the law to sue us based on the seriousness of the accusations it's making. If crimes had taken place, it's incumbent on the civil service, when it becomes aware of that, to raise that with the police and to raise charges. They never sued us once. They never filed any amicus briefings with the state prosecutor. Because, Peter, they got us out of that monastery on the basis of false accusations that they knew were false, even at the time they were making them. And if this goes ahead, if we're not able, because then the next stage is either we will appeal now on the back of these three sentences to the Cassazione, which is Italy's Supreme Court of Appeal. Either we will seek justice there and we will obtain it there, or we will go to the, bizarrely enough for Eurosceptics, we will go to the European Court of Justice in Strasbourg, which will 100% overturn what one of the lower Italian courts did. And the reason is this: because if this judicial act, which was that got us out, which was passed in a private session where my lawyers weren't present, There were no, I wasn't allowed to be present. There were no members of the public allowed to be present, no journalists allowed to be present. This is like medieval Star Chamber stuff. Mm. That's how they got us out. If that judicial sentence is allowed to remain, then what the European Union will be tolerating is effectively a constitutional charter for stuffed envelopes, because it will mean that not only the Italian civil service, but basically any nation's civil service across the European Union can unilaterally annul a perfectly legitimate contract with a third sector service provider at any point in time, based only on its word, never corroborated in court, that a fraud had taken place in the tender process. So you know, Peter, what the conversation's going to be. And in Italy and in these Mediterranean countries, everybody knows what's going to happen. It's going to be civil service, any service provider, civil servant will go to them and say, it's a nice contract you've got there. It'd be a shame if anything were to happen to it.
Yeah.
Right? But that is the consequence of what will happen if our eviction order isn't overturned. Massive consequences for the European Union and the rule of law in the European Union, just because they wanted to get Steve Bannon's Gladiator School for nationalists out from under their noses. That's the communists for you.
Well, great result, and obviously we'll be watching it closely, and I know you'll keep bringing us information not only on your social media but through War Room and here directly. So great story. Let's move on to see what else has been happening in the news. And looking over at Ukraine, interesting headlines and seeing more and more of these. Wouldn't have seen them earlier. It's time we talked about the fall of Kiev. And this is in the Times. Far from being a frozen conflict, a nightmare scenario was edging into view because the West is failing to send arms. I thought we did send all the ones we had available. And the nightmare scenario was, it discusses Russia is right at the gates of Kiev and is going to fall. This is the conversation that actually the war is not going the way the West hoped, that this little country, not small country physically, but small country militarily, with a tenth the military power of Russia, isn't winning, surprisingly, after all we sent. This seems to be a change in the narrative, Ben.
Well, look at that headline. It's time we talked about the fall of Kiev, right? My response to that, Peter, is I'm ready to talk. I am ready to talk about this. Look, the War Room has been absolutely clear on this right from the start of the war over 2 years ago. This war, from the Russian perspective, is existential. They will not tolerate NATO in Ukraine on their borders, right? That was absolutely clear for Putin, been clear for that for years. We pushed this, we in the West psychotically pushed it to this point, and as Professor Mish Scheimer said, we're now fighting Russia down to the last Ukrainian. That's really the Western position here. This war was only ever, because it is existential for Putin and for Russia, as it is not for Ursula von der Leyen and Joe Biden and the West. It is not existential for them. Though they're politically, it might be existential because they invested so much into it. This inevitable conclusion was going to come at some point, sooner or later. It was going to come. The question was, is how much of Ukraine were sociopathic overlords willing to feed into the paper shredder, as it were, until this reckoning was upon us. And the answer is quite a lot. Right. Hundreds of thousands of lives ruined, hopes of the infrastructure, the nation largely in some places smashed to smithereens, of which, of course, our sociopathic overlords will be ready to send more of our money to go in for the rebuilding of Ukraine if we let them. And attention, those of you in the European Union who will have votes in June for the European elections. Sadly, we won't have this is the possibly the one and only drawback of having left that corrupt organisation called the European Union, is that we cannot vote for nationalists in the European elections in June. But that will be an excellent opportunity, and we'll be banging this drum up until June, an excellent opportunity to change leadership in Brussels so that it does not spend hundreds of billions of our money, of our taxpayers' money. And fortunately, we are not in the European Union. But it is absolutely the case that our own national brand of sociopathic overlords is more than capable of throwing money at Ukraine, even without being in the obligation of the European Union. Obviously, for the EU, it's going to have huge infrastructure spending it's going to need to invest in Ukraine if Ukraine is going to join the EU. Hopefully, we will exploit the fact that we are no longer in that union, so that those expenses don't fall down on the British taxpayer. But it's absolutely important to at election times to pick representatives that are going to put our nation first. This is tragedy in Ukraine is even more tragic because its outcome was only ever going to be inevitable. As you say, it's a shift in narrative. It doesn't mean that Ukraine's going to fall today or tomorrow. When it does fall, they're obviously going to blame it on us because we were agitating to stop the arms and the money. So obviously we're going to get the blame for that. I'm happy to wear that blame. Personally, more than happy if it stops sooner rather than later, the pointless killing. But yes, that is the Murdoch press here starting to shift its narrative to prepare the West for the inevitable.
Yeah, and part of that, as you mentioned, we'll not discuss, but looking forward to those European Union elections, which will change the situation and possibly will change any discussion of Ukraine joining the EU. But moving from one conflict to another, the military machine needing conflicts all over, and this is in the Middle East. And intriguing this from the United Nations website itself, and it is Gaza Security Council passes resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire during Ramadan. On Monday, passed resolution demands ceasefire in the month of Ramadan, the immediate and unconditional release of hostages. Oh, that's good. That's a first, possibly. And the urgent need to expand the flow of aid into Gaza. There are 14 votes in favor, with the United States abstaining. In one way, I could mock this by saying, well, they do need aid because Ramadan is a Ramadan feast, because it is the biggest month of gluttony and feasting that you can get. But I'll pull back from those comments. It's weird. I mean, what does it matter what religious time of year it is, whether you have a ceasefire or not a ceasefire? Surely that should be irrelevant.
Well, look, on paper, that might be irrelevant for what is notionally a secular organization. But if you'll forgive me for saying it quite like this, I mean, my view on the UN, and this kind of story only goes to confirm this point of view, that UN is really the reigning throne of the Antichrist. Yeah. And that this story, I think, fits perfectly into that explanation. And because, you know, why do I say that? Well, because the Antichrist is the Lord of this world, specifically, really, that all that is not Jesus Christ is taken up and encapsulated in the person of the Antichrist. And the UN would appear to be the reigning throne, I think, of the Antichrist, for those of our followers who are eagerly awaiting the return of the King of Kings and our Lord of Saviour. The pieces on the chessboard are moving into place.
Can we say Christ is king? Of course we can.
I'm sure the UN would like to dismiss that kind of talk as hate talk. But the truth of the matter is just that they are on the wrong side of supernatural history here. But when I say that, I don't actually mean to be antagonistic towards Muslims. That's not the scope of what I'm saying. The point of what I'm saying here is and by the way, just to, as you were giving the analysis of this story, the precise words from the ceasefire resolution, where because it's the holy month of Ramadan, right? Right, adjectives are important. It's the holy month of Ramadan. And this is the thing that really gets my goat, because I don't remember seeing any emergency ceasefire resolution on behalf of the UN Security Council pressuring Putin into a ceasefire in Ukraine, because it was the holy 40-day season of Lent. Mm. Right, I don't remember reading that. And Ukraine is an Orthodox Christian country. They even made the grand gesture, I think about a year or so ago, to leave basically the old Russian Julian calendar and come on to the Gregorian calendar, which the rest of the West follows, and so that they would celebrate Easter as a consequence at the same time that we do in the West. Now, I say that I'm not supporting Ukraine in this one, not supporting Russia. Either my view on Russia and Ukraine is not my flag, yeah, not my war. And that is actually my view on with regards to Israel and Gaza as well, right? Not my flag, not my war. The actual issue of the ceasefire is I don't want to get into it, because I don't feel as if I have any great experience. I mean, I'm a full-time international correspondent following the news 24/7, but I don't feel as if I have any, you know, even with that attention, I don't to these things, I don't feel as if I have any right or expertise to come in and wade in to what is an intractable situation in the Holy Land, in the Gaza Strip, in Israel. And you follow these tit for tat things back long enough, and you're never going to find out who started it. It is just ongoing. So I think we're better off out. We shouldn't be supporting Israel. We shouldn't be supporting the PLO or Gaza or Hamas or any of those entities. Just stay out of this, because I think our presence on both sides turns us into a proxy war, where again we're just arming our notional allies to massacre the other side. If both sides retreated from this, then I think that would accelerate the possibility that they're going to sit down and talk, which is still very far away, because the rest of the world is cheering like a cockfight, and that is not conducive to peace. So then my point principally on this isn't to enter in on the side of Israel or Gaza. It's to say that the UN in this statement said something, slavishly prostrating itself down towards the sensibilities of Islam that it wouldn't dream about doing to Christianity. And I don't think I need to expand on this point, because all of your viewers will understand exactly what this dynamic is, and it has a supernatural basis to it. It has an eschatological basis to it as well, I dare to suggest. And as I say, the chess pieces are moving into place. You can see who is for the Lord of this world and who is for the King of Kings, the real King of the universe, by these displays of affiliation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Let's go on to another intriguing story. I think the first half of the stories were on your Twitter, and then a few are elsewhere. And this says, oh no, that's not that. Let me remove that. Give me one tick. And it is this story, which is about Italian houses. Let me just reduce that down. And here it is. Italian house. We've seen this a couple of places. Houses for €1, obviously trying to improve an area. And this is another one. This is from CNN. This Italian town is struggling to sell off its empty homes for €1. And here's why. And it's a town south of Rome. And they said they've only been able to sell, I think, two of them, of the ones they put up. Intriguing story, Ben, and I don't know, were you looking at the difference, the move to cities? Were you looking at actually the Italian economy? Is it actually people not wanting to move here? Or there are a whole load of aspects to this, and not only Italy, but a number of countries have tried to do this.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect metaphor for contemporary Italy, Peter, that they can't even give these houses away for €1. Now, Italy's one of them, I think, I think it is, personally, the most beautiful country in the European Union. And you've got to ask yourself, if the calculation is that people don't want to come here and buy a house for €1, there must be something on the other side of the equation that is even more pressing on people not to participate in this. And I gently encourage my Italian friends and neighbours to contemplate and consider, what is it about this country that they have made it so unattractive to outside investors who basically won't touch these places with a barge pole because there are obligations tied to these things. Come back to the first story about Trisulti. In a country that exhibits so little rule of law, who is going to come in and invest on that basis? Now, you mentioned the economic situation. Yeah, I mean, it's a problem with socialism generally, and job destructive legislation generally, that they've made it almost impossible to employ people in this country. You have high labor expenses if you want to employ someone, really high taxes on all these costs, make it very difficult to employ someone. It's very difficult for that person to produce enough wealth that it actually pays not only their salary but all the extra costs that are put on top that are for a company to employ that person. So there's been a flight out of the countryside and the rural areas into the cities in search of employment. And while you have that dynamic going on, you have so many youth leaving Italy full stop and going to other countries like the UK or Germany or even further afield in search of work, because there's no work. It's not that there's no work. The government has, as a consequence of government's own actions, as I say, that make it impossible to employ people. And so you have this situation here in Italy where you have, not only do you have the increasing age profile of the population, you have correspondingly an increasing ratio of worker to pensioner or pensioner to worker, I should say. You have more pensioners than workers paying for their pension. And when you have people leaving the country of working age to find jobs abroad, that basically increases that ratio yet further. And it creates a vicious circle. So there's no resolution to this unless the country is willing to have a fundamental rethink about what the purpose and scope of government and the welfare state is, and the damage that's creating to the employment fabric of this country. So you then ask yourself, if everyone's leaving, what is the solution of our Italian sociopathic overlords? And then, of course, that explains why, rather deludedly, they're letting thousands of people come in every day, basically illegal third world invaders who are coming into this country. And they're not coming, these people, Peter. This is just the hilarity of our sociopathic overlords. But these people who are coming in, they're not coming in. They ain't coming in to pay for Italian pensioners, right? That is not why they're coming here. And it's not going to happen. They're not doing that. They're expecting Italian pensioners to pay for them, right? So this country needs to have a real long think. And the government that was elected, Giorgia Meloni's government that was elected to do something about this problem, needs to ask itself serious questions as to why it's allowed the situation and to aggravate in the last 2 years. It's now double the number of illegals coming into the country, and that is now double from what it was under Mario Draghi, who was supposedly just like a central banking technocrat. This is you reopen any newspaper in Europe or the world, it says that we have a far-right government right now. I haven't seen any evidence of that, Peter. I don't use these terms far right or left or right, really, because they're pretty much meaningless. But just a little incy-wincy bit of far rightness wouldn't go amiss right now.
Don't worry, it's coming in the European elections. It's coming in bucket loads. So, well, here's a story about someone who actually could probably buy 100,000 of those houses, and that is Jeremy Hunt, the UK Chancellor. This is Jeremy Hunt telling us about £100,000. It doesn't go as far as you might think for people in his Surrey constituency after he was criticised being out of touch, Surrey being down the south of England. The Chancellor had previously tweeted that the sum was not a huge salary for people in the southwest. The average salary for a full-time worker last year was £34,000 and Surrey £42,000. So £100,000 would be three times the average UK salary. And I look at this, Ben, and realize, not that I need a story to remind me, how absolutely out of touch our politicians are. And they have no idea of the struggles that actually individuals face of trying to make ends meet.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I'll agree with every word of that, Peter, but I will add the caveat in that I'm not going to play the envy game. It's absolutely true that the government is oblivious to the struggles that ordinary working families have. They're often trying to have two jobs in order to make it to the end of the month, and still with two jobs not being able. I don't mean two working parents. I mean each working parent having two jobs, having a full-time job and then a part-time job, perhaps in the evenings or what have you. Just both parents in a family where that still exists, and they still can't get to the to the end of the month. And the government is oblivious to this fact. But I'm not going to play the envy game. What I mean by that is that Surrey is a very lucrative area of the southeast of England. It's very middle class. You have people from all over the UK. There's sort of moving down there. They'll start businesses, small businesses, wait for those businesses to grow when that was still possible. And then they'd relocate to the south of England and luxuriate in the product of their hard work. And I say to those people, God bless them. Sure. And it's true in that area of the ring. Where I'm from in Leicestershire, £100,000 is a king's ransom of a salary. It's not in the southeast of England. There is huge disparity in salaries across the UK. And for those people, £100,000 a year. It doesn't go very far. That's absolutely true. But my follow-on from that is going to be different from the Chancellor of the Exchequer. In my view on this, so how long have the Tories been in power now, Peter?
14 years.
14 years from 2010, right? And we're going to come back to David Cameron later on in this. 14 years. And what have they got to show for it? The destruction of the middle class in England, right? Their incompetence, right? Their absolute incompetence in running the economy, taxation. They have destroyed the middle class in this country so that £100,000, which was a reasonable middle class income and a reward of perhaps a whole lifetime's hard work and investing, that now doesn't take you very far. Thank you, Conservatives. Right. Thank you, Conservatives. Let's give you a little applaud for how much you've destroyed the country. Right. Scumbags. So that's my takeaway on that. They've destroyed the middle class. They've destroyed a middle class income and they've destroyed the value of the pound with their inflation and their destruction of savings. Thank you, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Right. How dare you present yourself at the next general election? Probably because he's going to lose his seat. Right, he's one of those earmarked and good riddance, right? Scumbags, these people. Yeah, this is why I call them sociopathic overlords, because they are these people in the UK. They have ruined the country on so many metrics, right? And I just want to go to the bottom of this this story in The Guardian, where he actually says, let me get this quote here. He says that actually the problem was really Ukraine. Let me get the actual quote here, right? Because I want to dig in on this. He says, the UK has been through a very, very tough patch, which was caused primarily by the invasion in Ukraine. Well, of course, it wasn't caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It was caused, the rough patch was caused by our sociopathic overlords' response to that invasion, right? The invasion itself would have cost us literally nothing if we had done nothing, right? As Putin had been picking off some of his old Soviet territories and annexing them This would have cost us nothing. This is basically following on from Boris Johnson, who has a Churchill fixation. And sees everything through the prism of the 1930s. Mm. Our own government has damaged British taxpayers many, many factors more than anything Vladimir Putin could have done. And I want that recognition, I want that thought to trickle down and to permeate into every British taxpayer who's following on the show. I know we have an international audience, right? But for Brits specifically, and it's the same story in the United States, yeah, right? Exactly the same story. But I want people to realise that their own governments, right, they never explained what they never once explained in a coherent fashion what our interest was in this territorial dispute between Russia and Ukraine. And the best they came up with was that if we don't stop Putin now, he's going to come in and invade. He's going to roll on into Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and so on. That's just bullshit, right? That's just bullshit that nobody believes, right? That is the lie, right? And they have bankrupted in England this admission from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, which for non-Brits is basically our finance minister, our Treasury Secretary, to use US terms, right? He's admitting here that as a consequence of their own incompetence and arrogance and hubris, they have created this very, very tough patch in the UK. And I want to make that point again. I will make this point again, right? We have been damaged. British taxpayers have been damaged by their own government factors more than anything Putin could have done, right? And I will just leave that in that analysis on that point. Shocking.
It is, Ben. Really have you seen the mock video for zero seats for the Conservatives?
No, I haven't.
Okay, let me. It's 2 minutes. Let me play this because we put it up on social media and it's mocking the Tories. Let me play this. It is so good and you'll enjoy it. Don't have time to comment, but let me just play it.
For 200 years, the Conservative and Unionist Party of the United Kingdom has bravely and consistently betrayed not only its own voter base, but all native peoples of the British Isles. From constitutional reforms to dissolving the British Empire, from desecration of tradition to importing endless migrants, it is the Conservative Party that has been on the forefront of the destruction of this ancient people and their lands. I am immensely proud of what we have managed to achieve as a party, taking the greatest empire to ever span the face of the earth to being a pathetic, miserable, and broken nation mocked the world over. In recent years, we have greatly accelerated our plans to crush the ethnic Britons, making sure we openly show our hatred to you at every turn. And let me be clear, we do hate you. We despise you. We have not done enough, though. Despite all of our betrayal, our blatant loathing of you, you still vote for us. Even as we refuse to simply deliver a referendum, and then when we do, we subvert your wishes by then opening our borders to the world. Even as we take all of your wealth and make the promised public services completely unusable, there are still some of you who vote for us. It is you, our voters, who we find the most disgusting. To combat this, I am incredibly proud to introduce our new policy, Zero Seats. Zero Seats is the policy where we shall do everything possible to make sure at the next general election, we as a party obtain zero seats. You will have already seen zero seats in action, such as arguing over how much of your money to send to foreign conflicts that are nothing to do with you, or straight up making you homeless as we lavishly treat foreign peoples and hand over your property to them, and then criminally punishing you if you so much as point any of this out. So please, when you think about the next election, think zero seats. If we all play our part, we can finally make zero seats a reality.
There you go. It was so good.
Genius. How is it? I haven't seen that. And for our non-Brit audience, that's Rishi. That's like an AI, capture of Rishi Sunak's plummy tones.
It's so good.
Narrating that. And that's word perfect.
It's so good. But let's go. I just thought it's good to let people smile as we mock our institutions. Let's see if we can do, goodness. Okay, let's just do about 3 minutes on each of these. So yep. Let's buzz through. This is compelled speech. Teacher loses claim of unfair dismissal after humiliating student over preferred pronouns. And this is teacher Kevin Lister. I believe now the case has possibly collapsed the next day from one of the jurors saying something and is going to be reheard. But it's again, compelled speech. We've seen it. Obviously, Jordan Peterson made his name off this in Canada, and we've seen it country by country, and it's coming into the UK. So thank you, Conservatives, for this.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you know, we'll put this into the file for the Zero Seats campaign. Look, 3 minutes, my point will be this. This just illustrates the absolute supremacy of the culturally Marxist movement, basically, in UK, in UK culture, in education, in the media. They're just absolute reign supreme right now. I'm old enough to remember, Peter, when the left, when our elite, our cultural elites, couldn't care less about pronouns, teaching pronouns in school. Let's go back 20 years ago, perhaps. Couldn't care less, you know. If you were interested in the, what used to be called the three R's, you were just basically a prehistoric relic that made it through into the modern age. They couldn't have cared less either about pronouns or marriage. And of course, it's all returned now, but not in the old conventional sense of the concepts. These have been radically transformed by cultural Marxism into different concepts, and not only are they now interested in these, they are totally intolerant about any dissent from them, and this is basically being a turn on a coin, and it's happened so quickly in relative terms. And, you know, as we've mentioned before earlier on in the show, 14 years of a supposedly conservative government, and all this has done, it has digged in, it has bedded down. Shocking. Yep. Like so much of what happens in contemporary Britain.
And, of course, the way we're going to defeat this and win, I believe strongly, is the media. And this was Grace Chong posting, Worm CFO, Steve Bannon's war remains a juggernaut. And this was from Axios.com article. And in that, one of the 12 areas, number six was MAGA mind melders. And talking about Posobiec, Mike Cernich, Charlie Kirk, Tucker Carlson, Don Jr. And there it has Steve Bannon's war room remains a juggernaut. The whole article is a great article. It's there. If you're watching on Rumble, then it's there. You can click on it and see it. I love this article. Actually, publications that aren't necessarily on the right, Axios isn't on the right, and yet has some great perceptive stories. And this is a great delve into the media war that I've certainly found myself in, as have you, Ben.
Yeah, let's just give Grace Chong a shout out for posting that. I know you mentioned her just a few moments or so ago. If you want to read out her Twitter address, Peter, I'd be very grateful for that.
Yep, at GC22GC, Grace Chong 22, Grace Chong. So there it is. Make sure and follow her.
The queen of trolls, as we know her, on the war. Look. This. Thanks very much for Grace. To Grace for posting this story, right? I think, look, my quick takeaway on this is that it just illustrates that no one is listening to the mainstream media anymore. Yeah. They've switched off. And that was a consequence, you know, watching the mainstream media's implosion over the last few decades is like, you know, if I can bring in a metaphor from the collapse of this bridge in Baltimore, right? It's basically watching a large, heavy cargo ship crashing into a bridge. Only the mainstream media's crash was decades in the making, and they had the power to adjust the steering. Right? They didn't. They deliberately turned themselves into a diminished force that half the country, in whatever Western country you want to pick, whether it's like the UK or or the US, what have you, they have switched off and they are no longer listening because they know they are being fed communist agitprop, and they have sought alternative sources of information. And this is where Hearts of Oak and the War Room have been excelling. And it's only going to continue as well. If you, I mean, just look, we're moving towards the US elections in November. You can just see the mainstream media cable news coverage. It's beyond sort of hysterical now. And by hysterical, I don't mean amusing. I mean like hysterical. You need to give it a slap because it has lost all. Or sense of reality. It is hysterical, it is shrill, and it strikes most people as being so as well, because most people have antennas and they recognize that when they're being fed something which doesn't resonate with their own sense of reality. This is what we have on the mainstream media. People are leaving. They're leaving in droves. It's now so many of these cable news networks are now on suicide watch, and people are coming over to us for the truth. And great, as they become more shrill moving towards November, we're going to get even more people coming towards us. These people have no self-awareness, Peter. Zero self-awareness, and they can't seem to realize why people are switching off.
Yeah.
And coming over to us, they don't seem to realize that the more shrill they are, the more shrill they are seen to be, the more people are going to say, "Look, you know what? I'm not interested. I want the truth." And the more they're going to come over to us. So let it continue.
Yeah, it says here, you can't understand November's election or America itself without reckoning with how our media attention has shattered into a bunch of misshapen pieces. And it says, not long ago, we all saw news information through a few common windows, TV, newspapers, cables. Now we find it scattered. I said, traditional media, at least as a center of dominant power, is dead. Social media, as a replacement for news in the internet era, is declining in dominance. So it's a great article. Make sure and make use of it. But we touched on Cameron earlier, and this is... I guess it does. It just explains what our so-called conservative government are. David Cameron posting a few days ago, 10 years ago today, the first same-sex marriages took place in the UK. It remains one of my proudest moments. If he wants to believe that that was progressive and good for the society then, he's entitled to that view. I believe he's wrong. But to say it's one of his proudest moments, wow. I thought actually looking after defence, the economy, getting people to be able to put food on the table, bring up kids, surely that's the role of a government, not to destroy marriage. And yet destroying marriage is his proudest moment. What are your thoughts, Ben?
Well, look, let's go back to the zero seats campaign that we just saw just a few moments ago. I mean, it was Rishi Sunak who was narrating that, well, the AI'd up version of Rishi Sunak. It could easily have been David Cameron, right? So he wouldn't have needed to have changed a single word for him to have been able to read off the same script. We were just talking a moment or so ago about zero self-awareness. That describes the modern Conservatives. They seem to be oblivious. This is the Tory party is the oldest political Conservative party in the world. And it is on the doorstep of oblivion, of eternal oblivion. And one of the factors that has brought it to that position is Nigel Farage and the possibility that he might return in an active capacity to reform UK. They're already on 16% in the polls, which if they were to achieve, then they might not pick up a single seat by this with 16%, but if they were to achieve that in the next general election, the Tory party would be down to about 40 or 50 seats. This is like a Canada-level wipeout. Mm. And they're oblivious to this. They're either oblivious to it or they just don't care. I think they're all narcissists, so that would explain their zero self-awareness, which is a classic symptom of people who suffer from narcissistic personality disorder, that you can't basically read the room because you're so obsessed by yourself. So they're pushing out things like this, and they are looking oblivious. These people are single-handedly responsible for bringing the oldest political party to the point of oblivion. They're responsible for this, and they're oblivious to it. So bring on the next general election is all I can say.
Yeah, well, last two stories, and this is from one awful politician to another awful pygmy politician. And this is, sadly for myself living in London, this is the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. And David Vance has put up, London at Easter, the ritual humiliation grows. At what point is enough enough? And Ramadan being celebrated above any Easter celebration. And it's part and parcel, I guess, of this is what multiculturalism is, isn't it, Ben? It just replaces the traditional parts of the country with anything else.
No. This isn't multiculturalism, right? Because under multiculturalism, you would at least have the presence of Christianity, right? There's no presence of Christianity from this mayor. In London right now. So let's explode the myth that this is multiculturalism. It's not. This is Islamification, right? Let's call a thing by its proper name. This is Islamification, right? Now, in preparing for the show, I'm going to depart from what most people might think I'm going to say on this, right? Islam, and I'm Darwinian about these things, right? When it comes to religion, because in religion, you either have truth or falsity. Christianity is a true religion. It is based on Jesus Christ, who is truly the Son of God. Islam, I do not believe, is a true religion because it's fundamental. Two truth claims aren't true, that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. I don't think either those truth claims are true, so therefore the religion Islam is not true. It's not supernaturally, objectively true in its truth claims. But when it comes to culture, I will always be Christian, right? Whether I'm, whether Peter, you and I are the last guys on the planet holding the true faith or not, it's not decided by votes. When it comes to culture, however, I am Darwinian, and I say let the strongest survive. So here's what I prepared. Islam is greater than post-Christian secularism. And we can see that it is winning. Islam is winning. The cultural presence of Islam in the UK is beating over the post-Christian secularist nature that the 1960s sort of revolution has bequeathed to us. And that is, accepting some responsibility within the Catholic ambit and also the Protestant ambit as well. This is the consequence of what we have when we introduce modernism into Christian practice. So Islam is greater, right, than post-Christian secularism. Christianity is greater than Islam, right? So those are the two points I want to make here. Christianity as a religion is greater than Islam as a religion. Islam as a cultural force is greater than post-Christian secularism. As I said, I'm perfectly Darwinian about this. Now, this is Easter, okay? So Easter is a perfect metaphor, right, for this point, because Easter, the term in Italy we use Pasqua, right, which comes from the Passion of our Lord, I think, which comes from Passus, which is Latin for suffer, or he suffered. I think that's the case, right? I think.
I'll agree with you, Ben.
Easter, however, Pasca in Italian, it might come back from to the Hebrew Pentecost. I don't know, right? But what I do know is that Easter isn't a Christian festival, right? That's the point I want to make. It comes from, I made a note of this, Austron. Right, who is the German goddess, or the old Saxon goddess of spring, Austron, and Erster via to Easter. Christianity, as a cultural force, co-opted the pagan festival of spring, right? Co-opted it, co-opted it, Easter, right? Easter eggs and all this of the pagan nonsense. We co-opted it. We put a cross on top of it, right? Now that Christianity as a cultural force is diminishing, is being superseded by Islam, they're going to put what do you call the half moon? I've forgotten the word in Islam. They're going to put the crescent on top of it, just as we did, right? Right. Christianity, the Christian tradition, or even the Judeo-Christian tradition, but the Christian tradition as a cultural force was superior to paganism, yeah, in exactly the same way that Islam is as a cultural force is superior to post-Christian secularism, which is nothing to do with Christianity, right?
Yeah.
So, and Easter is a perfect metaphor for that, right? As I repeat, the word is a pagan word. And now we can see here, this must be where I can't quite make out, what is this, Piccadilly or something?
Yes, I think it's all the way down Piccadilly and Regent Street.
Regent Street. So you've got the lights there. No references, zero. So yep. Supposedly multicultural, ain't multicultural, it's monocultural. And that monoculture is Islam, right? There's where that Islamic mayor. This is a consequence of decisions and voting decisions that the Brits have made over many decades. That's fine. Elections have consequences. These are the consequences we can see. Now we can live with this. And that is, you know, what more is there to say than that?
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I'll just bring up this. We'll not actually discuss it because we literally have no time left, but it is Sunday, Trans Day of Visibility. This is Newcastle City Council will be proudly flying the transgender flag this weekend to support Trans Day of Visibility. It takes place every March the 31st, just as if it wasn't visible already. But I'll just leave the viewers with that. Obviously, Easter Sunday is tomorrow, and I will be celebrating that, just as the disciples rushed to the tomb to find Jesus and found the tomb empty because he had risen. That's what Christians around the world, of those who are Orthodox, will be taking a different date. But the rest of us will be celebrating that time, which is the point at the time, the foundation of Christianity. And if the resurrection is not true, then Christianity fails and collapses. So it is the key event in the Christian calendar. So I'll be doing that. And I know Ben will be doing the same.
Well, Peter, you know, you might be worshipping the resurrection of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I'll be celebrating Universal World Global Transgender Day.
I won't even accept that comment, Ben. Ben, as always, it's great having you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks, and giving us your time.
Thank you so much. God bless. And happy Easter.
And happy Easter to all our viewers and listeners.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.